Welcome to the TWIML AI Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. Hey, what's up, Team TWIML? I hope you're all doing well and have managed to stay safe and healthy thus far in 2020. Here in the States, summer's starting to wind down, and we're celebrating the Labor Day holiday today. Where I grew up, in New York City, this is traditionally the last weekend before kids go back to school, although of course everything is a bit different this year due to COVID. Even if you're out of school though, it's a great time to add some new skills to your repertoire. And now that things have settled down a bit in the world, make sure that you're able to check off some of those New Year's resolutions before the end of the year. With that in mind, I am excited to announce the launch of our two newest study groups focused on the 2020 version of the Fast.ai Practical Deep Learning for Coders course, which is hot off the presses. This study group is free and open to anyone who is interested in deep learning, including beginners. There will be two sessions starting next week, one on Tuesday evenings for our community members in the Americas, and another on Saturday mornings for community members in India. Of course, if you're in neither of those two regions, you're welcome to join either of those sessions or help us get another session started that's convenient for folks in your area. Our Fast.ai study group is historically the most popular study group in the TWIML community, and we've helped hundreds, if not thousands, of students complete the course. Please visit twimlai.com/community for more information and to get registered. If you're less of a coder and more on the business side, you may be interested in our new collaboration with machine learning practitioner and instructor Louis Durard to bring his course and study group, ML Systems for Leaders and Innovators, to the TWIML community. This course is designed for leaders and decision makers who need to keep everyone on their teams, including data scientists, software engineers, product designers, and technical and business managers, all on the same page. You'll develop a collection of knowledge and tools that will help you focus your attention on developing end-to-end ML systems that generate value for your organization. This is a paid course, and this Thursday, September 10th at 2:30 p.m. GMT or 10:30 a.m. U.S. Eastern Time, Louis will be joining me for a webinar to discuss all the details. For more information and to sign up, visit twimlai.com/mlsystems. And don't forget to register for TWIML Fest, our virtual AI festival taking place October 19th through 29th, dedicated to celebrating the TWIML community. And yes, even if this is your first time listening to the podcast, that includes you. Join us for 3 weeks of live discussions, interviews, workshops, as well as meetups and social activities like trivia and happy hours. Sessions will span a range of areas from practical and technical topics to explorations of the broader ways that AI intersects with society. Register for free today at twimlfest.com and be the first to hear about important updates, giveaways, and announcements. And now, on to the show. All right, everyone. I am super excited to be here with Michael I. Jordan, distinguished professor in the Department of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science and the Department of Statistics at the University of California, Berkeley. Professor Jordan, welcome to the TWIML AI podcast.
It's my pleasure to be here.
It is super exciting for me to have you on the show. You are connecting, or we are connecting, with you being in Italy right now. And so we wanted to start by having you share a little bit about what brought you to Italy. Interesting turn of events where Italy was a early hotspot for coronavirus, but now it sounds like things are going pretty well in the country.
Yeah. I hope that people will appreciate how amazing it is that we're talking across the ocean right now and these packets are flying back and forth. And yeah, it's very, very striking. My spouse is Italian and I have Italian passport, therefore. And so with the kids, we decided we'd come to Italy about in midsummer, because it's this is the eastern, far eastern side of Italy, and life is really quite open. So restaurants are open, you can walk around town, and the kids can have a normal life. So that's why we're here. We probably can't stay much longer because I need to get back and start work back in Berkeley. But it is an example of a country. Maybe it's because it's smaller, but and maybe because they had a trauma early on, but people took it really, really seriously. And I think for about 4 to 6 weeks, you really literally didn't go out of your apartment. It was the whole bloody lockdown. And if you follow the trend, they really brought it down to near zero. And now it stays around a few hundred per day. And they do the contact tracing and so on and so forth. So somehow they learned quickly that there's a few things to do that are right. And I think it's taking everybody else a lot longer to get on board with the simple but critical things to do to keep this thing in check.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Well, I'd love to start by hearing a little bit about your career and how your interests in machine learning, artificial intelligence, and all the other things that you work on began. In 2016, you were named one of the most influential computer scientists worldwide. Did you start out with that in mind?
Yeah, no, I didn't. And I'm glad that computer science somehow welcomed me in along the way, because I really headed in a different direction earlier on. I think I was influenced by philosophy. There was a autobiography I read by Bertrand Russell when I was a kid. It's like three volumes, and he was sort of the early part of the century, last century, thinking about the mind and the brain and logic and thought and psychology and so on and so forth. And so that got me sort of kind of aware that there could be a science emerging of the mind, and aware that it had something to do with their traditions and philosophy of inductive thinking and deductive thinking and so on and so forth. But that was my vague awareness. I did not grow up with particularly good education, and I was intrigued by the idea that the big problems of our day had to do with not just computers, but with algorithms and with dealing with uncertainty in the real world. So computers, what I found missing in computers when I finally came to computer science, by the time I'd been already in cognitive science and seeing kind of humans who are thinking somewhat logically, but not entirely. And it was intriguing to me how we can be not logical, but at the same time, we're so powerful. And so computers didn't seem to have that. And it felt to me that computers needed to move out of the purely deductive world that they'd gotten kind of focused on. So by the time I came to computer science, I was already interested in inference and in decision-making and economic ideas and so on and so forth. But it really is quite a random walk. And I like to say that I really like interacting with students and helping them with career decisions and helping them think about what is the future and where it's going and all that. Talking about that, I think, is really helpful, not just to me, but for figuring out my own next steps, which are always vague and unsure, but especially for younger people to orient themselves in this kind of thicket of ideas.
That's awesome. So your academic home, at least at Berkeley, is in the EECS and stats, but you've also done quite a bit of work in cognitive sciences and biology as well. Are you still active in those communities?
Yeah, I'm active in them, less so. Right now, my main focus is bringing economics ideas together with inference and computer science. But even there, you find themes that are familiar from past lives. So in fact, economics is full of kind of Bayesian thinking, and where do the preferences come from, and how do people, approach economics problems? How do agents behave, and so on? So you're in the world of cognitive science, to some degree. Biology was really just because, again, it's the topic of the era, and so anybody who's living in this era who doesn't learn about molecular biology and the immune system and cancer and whatnot, I don't think is quite living the full intellectual life they could. Moreover, our field of data analysis and large scale data analysis in particular obviously had a lot of connections to what was happening in biology. And I wanted to kind of lend an ear and hear what was going on and see if I could contribute. And that continues. So I've learned a bit about proteins. I've learned a bit about how enzymes work and learned a bit about genomics and the three-dimensional structure of the genome is something I'm currently interested in. And these are just that's almost more of an intellectual hobby. But my main focus really is kind of learning algorithms and how they behave when you put them in real world deployments, and how they behave when there's large collections of people involved, and where all that's going.
Mm-hmm. And You mentioned that one of your primary interests today is in the economic realm and how that interplays with inference and other things in the ML and AI world. Elaborate a little bit on that. What's your thinking and direction there?
Yeah, so I never was really an AI person in the sense that it was never the main thing in my life to have a computer replace a human being. You know, that's kind of an interesting aspiration about, could that be possible? I don't think it's impossible. I do believe it's possible. I don't believe it's going to happen in our lifetimes. Humans are just too amazingly richly intelligent and deep and broad and so on. You know, that said, it's a fantastically interesting philosophical question. But I was always more interested in more the implications of algorithmic styles of thinking and what that meant if you put it out there in the world. In other words, there was a whole new infrastructure that links people, like this network is linking us right now, transmitting the bits. But what if it was more aware in some sense? Or what if the bits are given economic value so that we're actually, some transactions are happening, or that, you know, the value is being recorded and created? And, you know, what if there's kind of a market happening behind the scenes here? People are being connected in new ways. What are the consequences of connecting all of us, but not just connecting humans? What are the consequences of all the connections behind the scenes? So if you think about, just to be concrete, like the current COVID, coronavirus issues, we're all reading as much as we can about it. But behind the scenes, there's this vast network that involves doctors and people and researchers, but it also involves lots of data, lots of computers, lots of measurements, and putting it all together and then having it flow such that the right ideas are present at the right time and the right decisions are being made for the right people is a non-trivial, you know, exercise. And it's not even being treated as an exercise, really. I think it's kind of all just ad hoc. You know, we just do the best we can with what we got. But, you know, like, think about the banking system just as a point of comparison. Think about the ATMs, right, that we all can now go around the world. This wasn't possible in my parents' generation. We can go around the world and have a little card. We don't even need a card anymore, really. It's a cell phone. And our money is available to us anytime in any place. And, you know, billions, I don't know, maybe trillions of transactions are happening per day, and they're all correct. And even if the electricity goes out in the ATM machine while I'm halfway through my transaction, no problem. You know, if I take out money here and my wife takes out money across the world, we don't get docked twice, and so on and so forth. It's just, it's kind of, you know, it's astonishing that it works, and it really does. And you know, there's huge consequences if it didn't work. You know, our financial system could be endangered. There's lots of criminals trying to make it not work, and, you know, just all kinds of things like that. So it's not perfect, but it's sort of amazing and has had a big impact. And the current sort of medical response to COVID is nothing like that, right? It's an ad hoc collection of things where, you know, maybe some doctor read something somewhere and that, you know, triggered some thought, and, you know, and that's fine. There's a lot of that going forward, but it also would be nice if we wouldn't have so much loss of, you know, of human life and heartache if the right ideas were not kind of transmitted at the right times. So looking back, that will be more and more possible. Just like looking back, you know, when people started to first build electrical systems or chemical systems and factories and you know, steam engines and all that, eventually they got it right and it really was great. And it just did a lot of the wonderful things for people. But along the way, it was really not great. And that's kind of where we are right now. We're creating all kinds of artifacts, you know, including social networks that you know, just look fun, like fun. Let's just connect everybody up. It's easy. But it's turned out to not be so great in many ways, right, that it's pretty damaging to the human spirit, really. And so a field that builds those systems should also be a field aware of the consequences of building that and able to kind of steer it and, you know, or at least, you know, be transparent about what could happen and let people avoid some of the bad consequences. We're not there.
But there's so much in there. Can you maybe give us a few examples of when you're thinking about these large scale systems and applying kind of an economic lens to them? What are some of the specific questions that prompts for you and how you investigate those?
Yeah. Let's indeed be real concrete. I think that'll really help the conversation, help me too, to kind of grasp things more as clearly as possible. So I'm getting my favorite example these days, which if you've seen other podcasts with me to the audience, and my apologies, this is, you've heard it before, but it has to do with music, and it has to do with kind of people who make music and people listen to music. right? And I was lucky enough to meet someone named Steve Stout, who is a friend, and he's an entrepreneur, and he's also kind of been a music, heavily involved in the music world, the recent music world, let's say hip hop and Latin music and so on and so forth. So I got to know him, and he and I have kind of bounced thoughts back and forth. And so some of my thinking has been influenced by Steve. There's a company that he has that I have been on the board of advisors. It's called United Masters. And it has at latest, I think, a few hundred thousand musicians signed up. All right. So what is going on there? Why are musicians signing up to a company? Why do I find that interesting? Right. Well, music has economic value, right? And it should. Why should it have economic value? Well, because people who make music should be able to have a living, have a job and be able to have a career, making music. It shouldn't be doing it just for fun. In fact, looking forward, people talk a lot about missing job. And so that's an example of something. It shouldn't be a missing job. It should be a real job. Sadly, that market, that ability to have a job in a world like creating music doesn't really exist. And this seems strange because there's studios all over the world. There's music flows everywhere. So surely there is a very healthy music market world. And the fact is there's not. That there's a few people who still make, hundreds of millions of dollars. They were plucked out. They have talent, but they were amplified then by a system that made them superstars. And you would think that, well, that's just how life is, that everyone wants to listen to the superstars, and they do listen to the superstars, and that's fine. And then there's a lot of other people that make money in some penumbra. But you'd be wrong about that. No one, the fact is, if you look at the data, that 95% of the music being listened to today was not made by the superstars. It was made by people you never heard of. And 95% of the music that's been listened to today was music done in the last 2 years. So these are kind of things that no one knows, but it suggests there's a whole missing market. So who is making this music and who's listening to it? Well, it's largely a culture phenomenon. It's an inner city phenomenon. There's lots of kids who they get a laptop and they make music, and their music is often good enough that they stream it somewhere and it gets picked up on, and they can actually become popular enough that a lot of people will listen to them. And then they're the cool people to listen to, and that's who's actually listened to if you hang around younger people. Yeah, so isn't that just all great? Well, no, that's a sad story, because those kids who made that music, within a year or two, they won't have a job, right? And they really, so what can you do to fix that? So now, in some sense, the AI or data science comes into play, which is that every time someone's music is being streamed across these great networks that we've built, some economic value should accompany that. And I don't mean micropayments. I mean that if one of these kids is making a lot of music and hundreds of thousands of people, not even millions, are listening to them, they should be able to see on a dashboard at the end of the week who's listening to them, where in the country. Here's a dot every time your music was listened to. All right. And if they turn out to be popular in a particular city, they should be able to tell the venue owners and say, look, I'm popular there. Let me come play in your city. And we'll broadcast to the audience, because I'm connected to the audience, right? I have that data. So the data is the currency of the realm here. The data says that I now know I'm popular, and I can prove to you I'm popular. And so I'll come give a show there, and I'll make, $25,000. And if I do that three or four times a year, there's a salary right there, all right? Moreover, if I start to get connected to my fans, I can offer them to come backstage. I can offer them to I'll play at your wedding for $20,000 or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I can start to build a life and a career, right? And it's now not some company that's doing this for me or some agent. It's me, right? I'm empowered to do this, right? And I'm able to do this because of the data flow and people like me paying attention to what the data is and how to get it into the hands of the people who can act on it, and helping to create a market where the producers are connected to the consumers, okay? So this company, United Masters, is doing a good chunk of that equation, which is that it has signed up these young artists, telling them, don't sign with a record company, sign up with us, and we will help you. We will be the data scientists for you. We'll let you have a record company in your pocket, and we'll let you manage these things. Moreover, we will act as an agent for all of you. So if you the NBA website now, if you go there and listen to music there as you're watching the clips, it's these artists. So I get excited by that because I see that a little bit of AI and data science, the building of a producer consumer market, mm-hmm. the paid engine of the long tail, the concern about the matching and the balancing, the use, game theoretic and matching principles along with recommendation system principles, kind of all the guts of good machine learning systems. If you start to do that right, you can actually create this thing as a healthy market. And I can see it, very soon within not just our lifetime, but within the next few years, kind of 1 million people in the U.S. being involved in whether it's being listened to and able to monetize it, all merchandise that's being sold around it and so on and so forth. And I can see not just in the U.S., I can see Brazil, China, et cetera, each having their own music systems. And I can see companies emerging to support this. So in some ways, this all seems naive and easy and simple, and why not? Of course. But, it's not been what IT has done. IT has created like search engines or social networks, which are services that aim to, provide connections among people. But it doesn't actually preserve economic value or create new economic value. It just gives you data. And then you have to monetize it with advertising. And so that's wrong. I mean, it's limited. It's not wrong. It's just limited. And if instead you say, no, my job as an IT person or an AI person is to create this system that is a real market and allows people to come in and they participate in the way they choose. And I'm just going to run the system and make sure that everybody gets connected up in the right way. And I'm going to do this at a brand new scale. It's not going to be 10 people or 100 or 1,000. It's going to be millions. And in doing so, I'm like a real engineer. It's like a chemist who went from, to take test tubes in the lab who could then build a factory and tell you that thing is going to work. And so if as a field, we started to orient towards building that sort of thing, guaranteeing that it'll work, bringing in people, ensuring transparency, ensuring a working system, thinking about how to do that, it's not trivial. Then I think that would be a really great chunk of labor for us. It would be something we would do that we'd be proud of, something that would actually make the world a better place. And that's just music. So we could go on and talk about other disciplines, news or art or mm-hmm. whatever, where our style of work, IT systems, could create new ways for people to interact that actually give them value, that not just kind of hook them up and then I make money off of you by advertising. So I hope I give it enough of a flavor there. That was kind of long. It was obviously very long-winded, but it's not that common to hear people think that way. It's more common to think, hey, I can build a company. I can use all this latest gizmo stuff, IT stuff, and people will be attracted, and then I'll make money off of some way. I'll make it with advertising or whatever. Done. That's great. And then if I'm an AI guy, I'm going to take all that data and I'm going to create super intelligence, and I'll put that in there in the mix too, and I'll even make more money. I don't know what people have in mind really, but the naivete of all of that is breathtaking. And just a little bit of down to earth, hey, wait, isn't there a market here? Hey, can't we get some money into the hands of 16-year-olds who are doing cool stuff? Hey, can't we rethink this whole equation of what the IT is being used for? I just don't hear it enough. And so I'm maybe willing to sort of say naive things about it, but just to say, if you're a younger person, think about doing that. Create a company that creates a market that makes money for other people. You can take your little commission. That's great. That's a wonderful thing to aspire to. And if you're an academic, think about, hey, how could I actually create a market with millions of people or hundreds of millions of people that actually works, that isn't attackable or it doesn't collapse in a heap? How could I do that?
And is the core element of interest in there the idea of a marketplace, whether it's, two-sided or multi-sided? Is that what is driving a lot of your interest? I'll add on to that a little bit. One of the things that is really interesting about your work and some of your writings is that you often come back to this idea of kind of planetary scale. One of the best examples we have of that is the internet. And we referenced that a little bit earlier, the bits flying around. You don't think of that as a marketplace necessarily. It's kind of this undifferentiated infrastructure that was made available that we figured out all these incredible things to do with. And so do you think this idea of a marketplace is kind of a next frontier in some way, or is that just an example of, one of these planetary scale systems that you think is interesting?
Yeah, that's a great question. First of all, I don't necessarily love the word marketplace, but I find that when I use that terminology, a lot of people argue with me. So I must be onto something. Yeah, I must be onto something. But, you know, so I give a talk in an academic conference of about a year ago, just totally technical, geeky kind of people wanting to see the latest equations. And at the end of it, I, you know, mentioned the word market. They said, well, markets are terrible, aren't they? And I said, really? He said, it's responsible for global warming. And, you know, so it was like, okay, we need to step back a moment here, take a deep breath. You know, markets weren't created by academics or by powerful people. It was created, you know, somehow by human interactions thousands of years ago. And it was like, you have a little something, I have a little something. Hey, we could trade and we'd both be happier. And so it's a kind of a force of nature. It doesn't mean that it's like it solves all problems or that it's a good force of nature, you know, or good or bad. It's just there. It is there. It's been underexploited in our field. So, you know, the internet, no, I don't think it is a market. Right. The internet was a kind of human attempt to have no scarcity, constant availability, no limits. Right. And that's not real life. Right. Real life is about limits and about scarcity and about trade-offs. I can't do this because you're wanting to do this, or I can't do this because I got limits on my time or a lot. You know, that's real life. The mature human being is able to manage these kind of, you know, trade-offs. They can't do everything they want to do. And the internet was something about no trade-offs, folks. You give as much bits and bandwidth as you want, and let's just keep working and working and working. So that's true, right? And that's somehow just not real. And it had to kind of eventually lead to some sort of, you know, effectively chaos. And there's a bit of, we have a lot of social chaos right now driven by that way of thinking that it's all fine. So markets are actually kind of more of a constraint, which is that, hey, you're in the game, I'm in the game too. We can both get what we want, but maybe we'll find a way that we're both a little bit happy. So another way I'd like to say it is that, oh, you don't like markets. Well, you know, suppose I'm trying to do a form of engineering. I'm trying to do a mechanical engineering. You know, I know a little physics and I know a little fluid flow or something. And now I'm trying to create this new field where I build buildings and bridges or whatever. And I'm going to have principles for that, you know, based on basic physics. All right. And now the question is, should I use gravity or not in my new field? You know, well, I could say, well, gravity, sure, I could use gravity. It's part of physics, right? I have to use it. And someone said, well, no, but gravity is a terrible thing. What does gravity do? How many people die a year from gravity? Well, you know, lots. People fall down and hurt themselves in all kinds of ways because of gravity, right? And so, you know, gravity should be avoided at all costs. It's really evil. All right. And so that's a stupid way to think, right? And the right thing way to think about it is that gravity is just a force of nature. We can use it and we should, but we should also control it and be aware of the consequences and all that. So same thing with markets. It's a force of nature. You know, turning it off is a bad idea. So, but use it, but then be aware of what the consequences are. And moreover, markets, you know, gravity is kind of one thing. I mean, maybe it's not. I'm not a physicist, but markets aren't one thing. So there's matching markets, there's auctions, there's just all kinds already in economics. As we go forward with learning systems invading into microeconomics, you know, brand new kinds of markets have to emerge. You know, so like, you know, second price auction markets, that was a discovery just now, you know, in our lifetime. And there's just to be all kinds of new mechanisms like that that need to be discovered to make these markets actually safe and interesting and healthy and work at the scales we need to work at and all that. And that's an emerging field. And so, yeah, we're just saying markets and we're done, that solves our problem. No, but markets as a way to bring in more constraints into your problem, make it a little more social, and hint at all the challenges and then try to knock them off. Yeah, I'm very enamored with that way of thinking. So no, the internet's not a market. The internet was just kind of a pipe. That's fine. But I think we're going to be a much more mature field when we start to at least have a little bit of appreciation for the word market. Mm-hmm.
In the example that you gave with the music company, one of the key themes there was this idea of empowerment. But I think just kind of following along on this markets thread, we've also seen examples of, not to name a certain four-letter ride-sharing company, but using their market power to ultimately, allegedly take advantage of gig economy workers. I'm curious, I guess maybe the question there is, you know, do you think government regulation is a kind of a necessary component of markets, or do you believe that, you know, something else?
Oh, yeah, no, I totally believe that government regulation is needed. Yeah. So I know enough economists to know too that most of them agree that, you know, there was this thing called the Chicago School where unregulated markets were going to solve all the world's problems, and that's just not true.
Yeah.
Not, you know, empirically. And I think as we develop these brand new kinds of markets that are operating at scales kind of beyond the human capacity, faster than we ever could think, or bigger than we could ever conceive of, that it's not going to be just the kind of working it out at the local level kind of that humans will fight with each other. And if you cheated me, I'll come find you, you know. Well, it's not it. So we need many hierarchies of structures, starting from the local to the more global. And we're going to have to work out in tandem as we develop these learning systems and these data-oriented systems that help us make decisions that are in the world, whatever you want to call it, it's happening. And so I think taking in a mature market perspective will help, but then working with lawyers, legal people, working with sociologists, working with people who are public policy people, and trying to figure out what are the appropriate ways to regulate here so that we do the right thing. Economics also has a beautiful, it's kind of a dour field, right? It has this kind of, hey, I think I'm doing the right thing by putting in this mechanism, but the consequences of that are that, you know, incentivizes somebody to come in and do something that breaks entirely what I do. Well, you know, economists are pretty good at now thinking that through all the way to the end and sort of seeing, well, okay, that didn't work, but here's another way to do it. And I think, again, if we partner and we kind of work with that style of thinking, that it'll help us to understand what kind of ways to structure these markets. Also, this field of mechanism design is very kind of, it's probably the field part of economics closest to computer science, where you start to get the constraints and the algorithms of computer science. And it's not just open it up and it's a market and it works. It's no, that gives you, that's like gravity. That gives you a lot of the force, the basic oomph there. But then on top of that, you got to put various, these kind of constraints. You got to run the auction in this kind of way. You got to go up and down and so on and so forth. Such that it'll actually kind of give the socially desirable outcome that all of us aspire to. Now, if you add learning systems on top of that, where we're all kind of putting in our data and it's learning from us and we're learning from them, it just becomes much more rich and complicated. And so, yeah, definitely, I'm very much on the side of some regulation, and it's kind of the right mix. If you try to do it all top down, it's going to totally not work. The kind of the free market people are right about that. Think about another kind of market, just to be so you can help yourself think is, suppose that I'm trying to build an app that gets people to the airport as quickly as possible, right?
Yep.
We already have apps kind of like that, right? And so it, you know, it records some data and it figures out that a certain path from here to A to B is like the fastest, you know, based on the data. You know, that's great. So now it recommends, if I'm at A, if I don't want to get to B, it'll recommend a certain path to me. And if only me is using the app, then great. Or for a few people are using it, fine. But what if everyone in the city is using it? Mm-hmm. Right now, it'll send everybody from A to B, and it creates congestion. All right, mm-hmm. There's an economic phenomenon. There's scarcity that's not being respected. All right, so at that point, you could say, "Well, okay, I screwed it up. It's my job to figure out how to do the load balancing. I shouldn't be sending everyone A to B. So who do I send from A through C to B instead, and do the slower path?" Mm-hmm. Well, that becomes hard to know. You know, maybe I think I know you. You're an impatient kind of person, so I'll send you down the fast route, or you're an impatient kind of person, right? You can see all the trouble I'm going to get into. Rather, at that point, you got to sort of abandon being the pure top-down, you know, regulation-oriented computer science person, and be the more open markets person. You say, well, I'm going to give it as an option to people. They can pay a little bit more, maybe, to go down the street that's fast, because they know they're in a hurry today, and they're willing to part with a little of their money to, or they're today, actually, they're not subject to a hurry, they'll save some money for the future. So add some auction mechanism in there and do it in a clever way, so they don't actually have to run an auction as you're trying to figure out how to get to the airport, but have an avatar running an auction for you. And then now you can imagine that, you know, people go on the road that they're most, you know, that helps some of their utility. They get there quickly enough for their purposes. So now we've kind of created an economic style, you know, information flow kind of system that uses our in the moment kind of knowledge that we're looking for, and creates a system that overall would maybe make people happier. We wouldn't make only the rich get richer or create congestion because we're doing it being stupid. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What was really interesting in that example for me is that if you layer on this idea that the future will have these kind of marketplaces that you're describing, and the marketplaces will have built-in learning systems and intelligences, but the players as well will have learning systems in the form of agents or whatever. If we layer that into your example, Even today, you can open up your phone and it'll tell you, oh, it's time to leave to the, you know, to go to the airport because you have a flight at whatever time. Those algorithms, I think, are based on kind of map style algorithms, but you can easily imagine these interactions between the optimization that's happening in the market and the optimization that's happening with your agent that's representing your interests and trying to either, you know, save you time or gas money or whatever it is. And in the fields of economics and, you know, game theory, there's all kinds of research into interacting systems and how they behave and, you know, what is overall equilibrium, things like that. When I think about, you know, kind of bringing it back to ML and AI, I'm starting to think about things like adversarial relationships, which we're studying. Are there other examples of, you know, where we're studying these kind of interacting learning systems at this scale?
Yeah, we're not studying enough. There are a lot of people. There's a community called EC, Economics and Computation. That there's a conference is devoted to it. And it's sort of not in the central of, you know, a lot of machine learning people don't know about it. It's people who study really kind of algorithms meets economics. And there's not that much learning there, but there's some people, the few people in the world who do study those things are often found there. You know, there's things like, what if I have many, many actions, like in a classical game theoretic setting, there's like two actions or 10, or there's not hundreds of thousands. But in our world, there's often hundreds of thousands, all the treatments I could have for some, you know, medical condition, or all the paths I could take to the airport, or all the restaurants I could go to in Shanghai, you know, et cetera, et cetera. All the books I could read. So classical game theory doesn't have a lot of kind of 100,000 by 100,000, you know, or million by million game tables. If they had those, they would realize there's no way I'm going to know the numbers in that game table. All right. And so that's where we come into the picture, which is that we're telling you how from data to get numbers like that. All right. But now we can do things like, well, I can't explore all those numbers. I can't try every restaurant. I can't try every path airport, but you try it and you're my friend, right? And so like recommendation systems are explicitly about that, is that as a community, we try a bunch of options and then somehow the algorithms figure out a way to make recommendations that would fill in entries in the table, even though we haven't experienced them before. And also there's kind of an exploration exploitation idea in learning and statistics, which is really, really critical, which is, you know, there's many options I have to try today, you know, things I could try to do. Some of them I try because they give me a reward. You know, I had a nice dinner and so on. Some of them I try because I want to explore and because maybe for the future I want to do that instead. And life is kind of a mixture of these things. And so good machine learning people are aware and kind of know algorithms for trying to mix these things. It's not that common in other fields. A lot of other fields are either pure explore or pure exploit. So you can now think about kind of economic systems where, you know, I'm trying to get to the airport, but, you know, maybe I'm like in Italy and I'm kind of just happy to also see this countryside a little bit. You know, I'm more in an explorer mode. And so since I'm an explorer, you know, maybe the system, you know, the avatar, whatever, will kind of know that and it'll kind of give me a different experience than I might otherwise had. It's not just trying to optimize in a really dumb way, you know, or I go to the shopping mall, right? And nowadays there aren't really many shopping malls, but you know, you can imagine that, or I go to a commerce site. Sometimes I really just want to go there and buy toothpaste or know what I want. And I want just very little, you know, in my way between me and the acquisition, right? But other times I go there and I want to learn what's the coolest, latest thing out there. I want to have a social interaction. I want to sort of be entertained and so on and so forth. And so if our virtual world, you know, our avatar-driven virtual world was a little bit more like that, that it recognized that now you're in explore mode, now you're in exploit mode, and then, you know, structure your interactions and structure the environment around you would reflect all that, you know, that would be healthy. And it wouldn't need to know like all the details about my life to do that. It wouldn't be invasive. It would really more be, as you said earlier, like the word empowered. It would allow me to sort of give a little bit of information such that it would structure the environment in a way that I would find more appropriate for my current needs. I think that the IT Silicon Valley world was very too much top down. They thought they could build the system and it would be perfect and it would know everything about you. And if it didn't know enough about you, it would look even more into your browsing history and it would bring together all this information and so much so that it would know what you would want and it would anticipate your every need. And that style of thinking is, you know, God damn it, it's still too much there. They, you know, they want this little secretary sitting next to you that anticipates your every need. That's the dream of AI. Well, I don't dream of having that secretary myself at all. You know, I dream of really having a few aspects of my state kind of, you know, taken respected and my utilities and my preferences. You know, I want you to take some load off of me, but I don't want you to anticipate my every need because you cannot. And the idea that a company would be able to do that is both frightening and unrealistic. And so, yeah, this kind of idea, back off from that, folks, create something more like a little bit of a market where I go into a market here in Italy, you know, people are trying to sell things to me, but they're not acting like they know me that much. They're just giving me opportunities. And so our online world, I think, is needs to be more like that.
Mm-hmm. And on that, is that a statement about, you know, first and foremost about kind of the centralization of data and or the centralization of intelligence? Or is it about you don't have any interest in the technology being available to kind of enhance your life in that way?
That's a great question. You're heading in a direction I have less to say about, but very, very interesting, important. Who has the data and who has the power because they have that? And those are critical issues.
Because I'm hearing you say you'd love for this thing to get you on the scenic route in Italy and serendipitously maybe, oh, you know, you're passing by this amazing thing. If you stopped for 15 minutes, you'd have the time of your life. And kind of hinting at maybe more of the misgivings are the way that we're currently creating those experiences.
Yeah, no, I don't feel empowered by such a system. I feel bothered by such a system. And so I need to feel empowered. And there is a difference. And so this word power does matter to me. So whether it's centralized or whatever, if you use my data, then that's okay with me. But if in some sense you use it and I get value out of your using it, right? So if you pay me in some sense for my data. So in particular, a travel agent is a person who makes travel plans for lots of people. And they get better and better and better over the years, right? So when I walk into that travel agent, they're just really good at it. They know how to get me from point A to point B in a great way. Well, why? Because they got you to that point. You know, they had experience in the past. So all your data is being used to help me. And are you unhappy about that? Well, no, that's what a travel agent does. They kind of take that data. And so a system that does that, that kind of, you know, somewhere, some partially, you know, anonymizes me, but that builds up experience dealing with people like me. And then I kind of know what I'm getting. You know, this travel agent doesn't need to know everything, but they took away enough to help somebody else. I'm good with that. The medical system, you treat me, it works for me. I want it to be available for you tomorrow, right? I don't want to protect that data. So I do want data to flow and I do want it to quote unquote be centralized, but I don't want it to be used as an advertising model that you have a lot of data about me. Therefore, you can tell other people, the advertisers, how to come find me. Right? That doesn't empower me, that doesn't help me and help you. But for humans to help each other via data flows and for a company to help provide that and then even take a bit of a cut, that's more my comfort zone. So I would, yeah, definitely not a, you know, all on or all off here. You know, it's always in the middle. It's not that there should be no, you know, data collections and centralization because that, you know, prevents you from actually having nice flows that are helpful to people. You know, but also not a just you can take my data willy-nilly. No, there's got to be kind of a valuation of data. There's got to be that you pay me in some sense for data and that I'm kind of okay with that equation. So if I go to a city and it's a restaurant application, it's trying to give me recommendations of where to go. You know, if I'm in a foreign city and I don't speak the language and it's 7 o'clock and I'm hungry, I really would like something really, really good that knows enough about me.
Yeah.
And the environment and all that can really put me in a good place to eat, that it's not, you know, weird or scary or whatever. And I'm willing to give up a little bit of privacy for that about my past or about where I am and all, but not too much. Right. Mm-hmm. And there needs to be a way to find that, you know. And so I think that's, again, somewhat economic here. There's a trade-off being implemented there. There's a trade-off between my privacy and the value I will get out of being, you know, being helped with my decision that was otherwise extremely, extremely hard.
The travel agent example is a really interesting one to me. I'm guessing that probably the vast, vast majority of our listening audience has never used a travel agent. Probably only those of us who have can appreciate what a good travel agent really brings to the table. And it makes me think that we think about this idea of, you know, we think about AI in the context of this digital divide, and there will be communities that will be left behind because they don't have ready access to AI technology. But the travel agent example makes me think that in a lot of ways, it's like a human divide in a sense, and that we need to worry about, and that the knowledge of humans is going to be commoditized into these computational systems like AIs, and only the select few will have access to actual humans who know things and have experiences and can help them in whatever the endeavor is. Travel agent is a great example of that. It gets really scary if it's medicine, for example, where the masses are being treated by kind of the commoditized robot doctors, but only the select few can actually speak to a human doctor with real experience. Do you see that as a direction? Do you think economics plays into that? Is that something you worry about?
Yeah, I do worry about all of that. I think those are very critical problems. Again, it's not enough just for someone like me to worry about it. It's got to be a joint effort of lots and lots of people. But indeed, bringing in all the right people and making sure there's a full-throated, diverse collection of people, backgrounds and interests and all that associated with the rollout of these things is so important, critically important. Maybe a little bit on the optimism side. A lot of the things that I think are interesting about my own life are kind of contextual and local. And the knowledge that's available there is not something that Google's going to have. Most of the things about my life that are interesting and all, Google doesn't know anything even to this day about. My searching browsing pattern is pretty limited and uninteresting. And I click on all kinds of junk. I clicked on something the other day about, the Queen of England or whatever. It's just because I just was lazy and I just clicked on it. I have no interest in that whatsoever, right? There's tons of really noisy, messy data in places like that that is kind of irrelevant within 30 microseconds, not to mention 2 years. Mm-hmm. All right. So most of us have a more local environment around us that we help to construct and we participate in a little more like a village. And by making and being having that, not being excluded from that and having that be, a healthy, good place, I'm a little less worried about that there's going to be extreme stratification of, this kind of technology. Mm-hmm. Also AI, first of all, be clear, this is data analysis, really. It's not magic. These are ideas that are totally open and available to, they're on the archive. They're simple algorithms. There's no mystery. People all over the world know what gradient descent is and so on and so forth. So moreover, computers are pretty much a commodity nowadays. And the data, again, it's very contextual. The data relevant for some situation in Brazil is not the data that's relevant for, Palo Alto. And so it's not the Palo Alto people are going to take over because they have all the, the goods. And then the people trained to solve the problems are also local too. So I still think our local community building and our cultures and all that are going to be, critically important as we go forward. But there shouldn't be kind of, fiefdoms and, enclaves, there should be and so it's going to require, all the right kind of people to be involved in the construction of as we build. So the medical one is a good example. COVID has definitely decimated minority communities more than it has decimated, rich and white communities. And this is a great example of that. Hey, shouldn't that be like, why should there be a racial discrepancy there? It's a goddamn virus. Well, there is, because that reflects all of our ways of our systems have been built and have been built ad hoc and have built all without thinking about that. And those have got to be knocked down and broken and thought through and make sure that those kind of things are, mitigated and don't happen. Yeah. So very, very important issues. And I just think mostly it's less about those of us who think about the mathematics and the systems kind of doing it all right. But ensuring that all the right people are in the room when the systems get built and then it's transparent all the way through. There's never kind of a black box that the society can't look at.
Mm-hmm. So we've been kind of going with the flow of this conversation and it's been wonderful. And I do want to kind of touch on a ML specific question, but even before we get to that, one of the things that is, just very clear in chatting with you is that, you have tons of ideas and you're currently exploring, kind of this intersection of economics and machine learning and marketplaces. And, you've worked in biology and other fields. I'm just curious, in getting a little meta here, your process or philosophy in kind of wrangling these ideas and turning them into interesting or even award-winning research or economic endeavors?
Yeah, thanks for asking. Let me just sort of say, to me, that's a question that's more about talking about younger researchers, how they could kind of get into this field. Really, that's what comes to me, because I don't think I have any major secrets myself. I wouldn't look at my own career, my own way of approaching things and say, wow, I figured it out. Well, I didn't, you know, and so part of it is I've been doing it for a long time. But, you know, secondly, I think that most of the challenges, if you start to realize what a real challenge is, one that will make a difference, that impacts or at least touches on issues that people care about, that is worth kind of a 2 or 3 years of your time, those are kind of the ones I go after. If it's going to be like a month of my time, I'm not particularly interested in it. And if it's going to be hopeless, you know, like, you know, Fermat's last equations, So I kind of find these ones at 2 or 3 years of my time. So I get up every morning and I make a little progress on it. And I just, especially for young people, just sort of each one of you is smart enough to work in this field. Each one of you knows enough. And so, you know, but make sure you pick a problem that is kind of meaty and it feels like it's not obvious and it's not what everybody else is working on. It's kind of got your own flavor to it. And it feels like after 2 or 3 years, you should be able to make some progress on it. And then just keep getting up and hacking at it every day, you know, and if you get a little frustrated, pull back for a while. But that said, every day, I like to say that half of my day is devoted to just kind of exploration. I read books on stuff. I think about, you know, I look at what other people are doing, or, you know, I just learn about something brand new that I've not known about before. Half of my day, if I can, this is on good days. And then half of my day is devoted to this. Let's keep moving some projects along. Let's keep kind of doing where I was doing. And if it's not moving along, you know, I'll kind of refocus. But those time scales are really important to me. Kind of, you know, the main one is kind of my overall life. Have I been thinking through all the things I kind of want to think through? What matters? Do I know enough about X, Y, and Z? You know, so, well, the way I do that is I go find a really good senior or junior level textbook. And I read it like a novel because I just find it really fascinating. Wow, these people thought this, all this stuff. Moreover, I kind of already know enough math that I can kind of just read it without having a lot of struggle. Like maybe the undergrad would have struggled. I don't have to struggle. It's so fun. And then I do that a little bit, you know, all the time. And over time, that's just kind of, you know, really helped and build up and given me a bit of a perspective, you know. But I don't feel like I'm necessarily a thought leader. That I think that partly that has to do with the era you live in. And maybe we're arriving at the era now where thought leaders will emerge. That it kind of starts to become consequential. Our field is mattering enough now so that we will be kind of burned by doing the wrong thing. And we'll also kind of learn by doing the right thing. And then maybe after that, your experience will kind of, you know, boost you the level of thought leader. But we don't have a lot. Our machine learning field has not been very consequential. It's really been in this era of just gee whiz kind of stuff. And behind the scenes, people have used it to build kind of, you know, infrastructure for things like, you know, Amazon or Google. And that's all great. And some of those people maybe have a, you know, gotten real perspective, but often it's very, very technical and very, very buried. And our field hasn't kind of emerged like some other fields where they were really having consequences for the human life. So I'm kind of hoping the younger people will realize that this is what's happening, that our field is going to have major consequences. So educate yourself broadly, spend time every day learning lots of things, and learn how to talk to the outside world, not just yourselves. So I'm not sure I answered your question, but I hope that was
That's a great answer to that question. I think the way you structure your time around thoughtful balance of explore and exploit is an interesting answer to that question. And so to kind of close things out, you are very well known for kind of the popularization of a bunch of techniques in the machine learning community, you know, Bayesian networks, variational methods, approximate inference, expectation maximization. Any thoughts on kind of the, you know, technical direction or elements of research or where you see things going kind of at this intersection of machine learning, computers, and statistics?
Yeah, no, I have lots of thoughts about that kind of thing. If especially younger people want to learn more about my work and thoughts about that, there's talks on the web that you can find. I think just to say briefly, a lot of my work has had to do with optimization, kind of what's the best way to do something. And even kind of lately, kind of what's the optimal way to optimize. And so this word variational has had a real impact on my career, my life, and my thinking. Variational just means you take a problem and you turn it into an optimization problem. All right. And having done that, you can often get new perspective on ways to kind of tweak that optimization a little bit and solve a slightly different problem and get inside of your original problem. And so variational methods of all kinds are still kind of a very part of my way of thinking. Optimization also has to do with change. It has to do with movement, it has to do with dynamics. So a lot of my work has to do with dynamical systems, differential equations, partial differential equations, stochastic differential equations, how fast they converge, how well they do in high dimensional spaces. And then with this economics kind of perspective that is driving me a lot now, the problem is now not just to go downhill and find at the minimum of a surface, it's often to find an equilibrium among multiple agents. So how does each agent kind of move towards equilibria? So the classical equilibrium of game theory, you know, limited perspective, you know, Nash and Stackelberg and all, that's just kind of how do you get there? It, you know, was never really talked about. Well, the whole question is how do you get there and how does data inform how do you get there? And even and if there's multiple people interacting in a complex world, you may never get there. It's more about the how do you move? And so lots and lots of interesting things have to do with stochastic dynamics and in the context of games and our perspective on high dimensional optimization and so on and so forth. So I just have a lot of fun with all the huge mathematical challenges there. You know, a lot of them are mathematical dynamics and dynamical systems. But then always behind the scenes, it's always about inference. It's about how did you sample things from the real world? What can you say about the real world based on what you got after your algorithm runs? What does that tell you about the real world? What's your uncertainty? And all these things. So statistics is kind of in some ways my home field where my heart really is. It is the field where I think the biggest challenges are about. You're trying to say something about the real world based on something partial. And that continues to be, I think, the hardest and most worthy field for many of us.
Awesome. Well, Michael, thank you so much for taking the time to share a bit about what you're thinking about nowadays with us. It was wonderful speaking with you.
It was a real pleasure to talk to you too. Great questions and a lot of fun hour for me too. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, everyone. That's our show for today. To learn more about today's guest or the topics mentioned in this interview, visit twimmelai.com. Of course, if you like what you hear on the podcast, please subscribe, rate, and review the show on your favorite podcatcher. Thanks so much for listening and catch you next time.